Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast for Tuesday, May 14th, 2019. If you don't know what day it is, you know, you are clearly not paying attention to probably the most hyped phone of the last few months, at least until since the Galaxy S10. This episode will be dedicated entirely to the OnePlus 7 Pro, a little bit to the OnePlus 7, but the one that we're more interested in is the Pro. It's the more expensive variant, and I think way more interesting. So to talk about it, we have Andrew Martinick. Welcome back from Google I.O.
And most importantly, welcome back from the allergy capital of California, which is very important for me.
You are always beset.
Yeah.
This time of year does not treat you kindly.
It does not, and that particular area does not. So Google I.O. is fantastic, but my goodness, I enjoy breathing again.
And joining us from the other side of the pond, also at the London launch event, Alex Dobie. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and I'm appreciating the lack of allergens in my body right now from having skipped Google I.O. this year. And immediately when Andrew was talking, had flashbacks of just the clouds of pollen that that permeate that place. But so it's good to be back here.
So we had two episodes last week for you. If you haven't heard them, the first was Andrew, Russell, Nirav, and Michael Fisher talking about all the Google I.O. announcements. There were a few of them, including the Pixel 3a and 3a XL, new Nest Hub Max, and a bunch of developer announcements. Really, really interesting. And then we had a bonus episode where Russell walked around the Shoreline Amphitheater interviewing developers, which was great. And I highly recommend you listen to both of those before listening. Well, you can finish this episode, but go back after that and listen. Make it a hat trick of sorts.
Whoa, that's a nice reference. I can appreciate.
Yes, thank you. So we'll dive right in. The OnePlus 7 Pro is coming at the end of this week to North America, May 17th. It's going to start at $669. We're not going to bury the lead. This is the most expensive OnePlus phone ever released. Well, sort of, but let's dive into why, because this is definitely the most impressive phone the company's ever put out. Alex, what have you kind of taken away with from your few days with it so far?
So the first important thing to sort of understand is that we have two phones, but it's not a OnePlus 7 and a OnePlus 7 Lite. There's a reason why it's a OnePlus 7 and a OnePlus 7 Pro. So you have the regular 7, which we'll talk about in a sec, but the regular 7 is pretty much the phone that you would expect OnePlus to release at this time of year. The reason why it's the Pro is because they're actually taking a step beyond that place that you would normally expect a OnePlus phone to occupy. So there are a lot of significant hardware improvements, a lot of design improvements. The phone is just a lot more impressive at a technical level and a lot more competitive with, I think, the likes of Samsung and even Apple.
Yeah.
This is OnePlus sort of taking it to the next level, and that's what the Pro moniker really means, is that they're no longer just this sort of scrappy upstart company that'll sell you something with the latest Snapdragon and near stock Android for a reasonably affordable price. They were actually sort of taking it to the bigger players in the game, I think, with the Pro.
Yeah, it really feels more like an actual direct competitor rather than just talking about the whole for the price thing.
Yeah.
Where, especially when you look at things like what they've done with the display, we'll talk about the display a ton, and the design, and just a few of the additions all around. It doesn't feel so much like a bare bones kind of reference designy type of phone. I mean, even the 6 and 6T, which, you know, were the best designs, you know, they've definitely gotten better with each generation, and even, you know, their half generations with the T models. The 7 Pro feels like a dramatically different device on a completely separate track and level from the phones before it in terms of hardware, just design-wise.
You could stick any premium smartphone manufacturer's logo on the back of this thing and it wouldn't look out of place.
Absolutely.
All right, so this is the company's first phone with a triple camera setup. It has a 90 hertz display. It has arguably one, you know, it's gone from having some of OnePlus phones have gone from having some of the worst haptics to having among the best haptics. So everything in here has been improved. It has obviously the latest Snapdragon processor, up to 12 gigs of RAM, up to 512 gigabytes of storage.
Stereo speakers.
Yeah, stereo speakers. What it doesn't have, you know, off the bat, it does not have wireless charging, and it is not technically water resistant. It doesn't have an IP certification. If you've seen the bucket promo that was released, I guess now just under 2 weeks ago, you'll know what that means. The company does not like paying for that IP certification, but it's also saying that it'll withstand some ingress. Just you shouldn't probably swim with it. So these are the compromises that OnePlus has made to keep the price at, you know, a relatively low number. $669 is still way cheaper than even the Galaxy S10e. And yet this is clearly aimed at the top of the line products on the market, and it's got carrier partnerships, or at least partnership in the US to boot. So Alex, where does this place OnePlus in the ecosystem now, especially in the West?
I think you have to treat them as a very much a tier one manufacturer, right? It's been a long time coming, but I would absolutely, in terms of the market presence, they're they're maybe not quite right up there with Samsung, and maybe this is me sort of having blinders on a little bit in this, you know, the smartphone enthusiast space that we all live in. But I think we, in terms of the quality of the product, the price, you have to treat them as one of the big players out there, especially if you look at where people like Sony, LG, HTC are these days.
Yeah, and they're doing it at a lower price still. It's just, it depends where you're coming at it. If you're looking at it as a whole market situation of, like, what do you get in a high-end smartphone and how much do you pay? Anybody could, like Alex said, you could put anybody's logo on this and it'd feel right at home in terms of the design and the experience and everything. I think that OnePlus fans, kind of your traditional OnePlus fan, is maybe going to be less enthused by this considering the higher price.
Let's talk about that strategy, because now the OnePlus 6T was the first phone to be sold at a US carrier. T-Mobile really hyped it up at the beginning. It was the same sort of $550 price, just available with financing. And it was put in stores right next to the iPhone and the Galaxy. We're not clear how many units it sold, but it was in the low millions. It was relatively competitive for the amount of time it was on the market. If you remember, it was released later in 2018. So this is obviously ramping up that price, but does it undermine some of that value marketing, or at least some of the reasons that people love OnePlus as a company by releasing a phone that is now, if not, priced the same, just a little bit lower than the flagships?
Well, I think OnePlus's relationship with the whole price point thing has always been a very sort of, it's been a relationship of convenience. They've never really leaned on that too much. And as we've seen over the years, the price has steadily gone up. And, you know, maybe with certain releases, there've been like value, you know, the value proposition has maybe been a little bit better. I think it's just part of the natural progression of the company to, you know, becoming one of the bigger names and becoming actually really competitive at the high end. Ultimately, you want to compete with Samsung. Maybe you're not charging Samsung money, but you're still going to charge quite a lot. And that, you know, in order to do that and satisfy the people who would expect a OnePlus phone to be sort of cheap and cheerful, that's why you also have the regular OnePlus 7. How that plays out in the US, where the regular 7 isn't being released, we'll have to wait and see, I think.
And they do still have a fantastic value proposition here. It just happens to be at a higher price. Yes, it's $120 more. Of course, it depends on the SKUs you're comparing and all that. But I feel like this is far and away easily $120 nicer than the 6T. It across the board, when you look at the display and the hardware and the new cameras, this very much feels like it's competing and still punching well above its weight, even though the price has gone up that much. And I think people are going to be able to justify that just fine. It just no longer play. It's just actually now fully playing in the flagship space. Whereas before, we've talked so many times about how OnePlus kind of occupied this weird middle ground between the like low mid range and then the flagships, because they were so far apart. Like now they're a little bit closer when you're talking about the 8 gig, 256 gig 7 Pro is $700. Like you're starting to get into like the Galaxy S10 is on sale right now for like $850. And so you're starting to play, you're really actually playing in that arena.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think if you had a Samsung logo or something, like I said, you know, forget the OnePlus branding is on the back of this thing. Imagine someone else's logo there. If that were the case, this would be like $900 plus.
So let's sort of go through the specific upgrades here, because I think from a design perspective, it is a much nicer looking phone. It's very heavy. It's extremely tall, and it's just a big phone in general. But that's not necessarily it's not different from any of the major releases of the last few months, right? The Galaxy S10 Plus, big, heavy, big battery. But the screen is really, really interesting, and I think it's going to be one of those heavily marketed features that will sell this phone, you know, a hero feature. It's got a dynamic 90 hertz refresh rate, and it's got a QHD resolution. It's a vivid OLED display. It supports HDR 10 plus. We already knew this because OnePlus has been trickling out information as it always does. But in person, in practice, this is a very, very remarkable improvement. It's a big deal. Andrew, have you found this to be kind of a game changer for you, like it has for me?
Oh, it's no longer that was the one, well, the haptics were bad, really bad before, but that was the one thing, of course, you interact with most. And on the 5, 5T, 6, 6T, it just was not good enough. You could always point to the display and say, no matter what, if you're charging this amount of money, and you're going to try to say that you're competing with the flagships, these displays were just not good enough. They were washed out and not bright and just didn't have that next level of quality. And the 7 Pros definitely does. It is right up there with everything else that you would spend $900 or $1,000 on. The 90 hertz refresh rate is absolutely fantastic, especially when you combine it with just how fast and smooth OnePlus's software is. It's really like they so go hand in hand with being able to, you know, flick through a list of something, or you're just going, even just going through the settings or switching apps. Everything is extremely fluid, and it really works well together. And then at the same time, you get just really good viewing angles and colors and crispness and brightness as well. It's just across the board, it's really, really good. It's still just a tiny bit shy of what you get from Samsung's own panels and its own phones, where it's, you know, those are just the best of the best of the best. This is just barely below that, but I mean, you really cannot complain about anything here.
And I think the 90 hertz angle is kind of interesting that we're getting that spec in this phone, because it's arriving just at the time that OnePlus is starting to have significant sort of brick and mortar store presence, especially in the US. And for the kind of feature that it is, it's very hard to convey the difference the higher refresh rate gives you on in a TV ad, you know, because you're limited by the refresh rate of what you're looking at. And so unless you get it in front of someone and actually point it at their face, it's really hard to actually show the difference. But, you know, OnePlus has that carrier store presence now, and, you know, a salesperson can put it next to an iPhone, put it next to a Galaxy, and actually show you the difference and how it is actually better and smoother. And it's something that's very hard to convey through other means, but very, very obvious when you have the phone in front of you.
That's a really good point, Alex, because, you know, so much of phone sales, so much of OnePlus's original draw to people was just that it was a very well-specced phone for the price. They no longer can get away with that. Even in the West, there are so many other brands that are competing just on specs alone. And while this is obviously a very top of the line phone, it has really obvious improvements there that you'll need to pick this phone up and feel it. You'll need to see that the color on the back, you know, that the new Nebula Blue or whatever it's called. There are some small touches here that really make it a big improvement over the 6T. I wonder, you know, there's also an in-display, a new in-display fingerprint sensor here that, like on the Huawei P30 Pro, is supposed to be a second generation in-display. It's still optical, but I don't know, Alex, have you found this to be as fast as I have? Because it really isn't a problem anymore.
Yeah, it isn't. It's not as good as capacitive, if we're talking just about accuracy and speed and everything else, but it's good enough. It's good enough in a way that pretty much everything released last year with an in-screen fingerprint scanner wasn't. It's of that the same level pretty much, I think, as the P30 Pro, where it's okay. You can use it every day and it's not a constant pain point. The only thing I've noticed, and this is, I think, is common to a lot of in-screen fingerprint scanners, especially optical ones, if the initial scan of your fingerprint when you're setting it up is bad, then you're going to have a bad time with it. And if you notice that either with one finger or with one hand, you're constantly getting misreads, probably time to go back in the settings and rescan that finger. There's nothing really in the software that tells you to do that, but you just have to kind of intuit it. But yeah, if you have a good setup process, if you actually get your finger scanned properly, yeah, absolutely a good experience with this.
It's been really, really good for me. And I think that the biggest difference is that the sensor area is like a third larger than on the 6T. And it's about, I would say it's about the same increase in size from the Galaxy S10. And whereas on the S10, you really feel like you have to just absolutely nail that positioning, you know, no matter how many different ways you enroll your finger, get it set up, like Alex was saying. Whereas on the, you know, on the 7 Pro, you just drop your finger on there and it just goes. It doesn't seem to care as much about different angles or kind of coming in more vertically. You know, like if your phone is on a table, it seems to handle, you know, coming in with the tip of your thumb just as well as the side or, you know, at whatever angle you're holding.
And also a lot easier going with the amount of pressure that it expects. I remember with the last generation sensors, especially the 6Ts, you had to really press firmly on that scanner. And if you didn't, you know, you wouldn't really have a great experience. Not so much with the 7 Pro.
So there's one other thing about the screen that we haven't mentioned, and that there is basically no bezel around either the top or bottom, and there's no notch, there's no hole punch, there's nothing.
The tiniest of chins down below, which if you look really, really close, you'll see. Yeah,
but it's really not distracting, and at the top there's barely any bezel. There's just enough room for a wide and kind of shallow earpiece, but that's because it's the first phone, at least in North America, to have a pop-up selfie camera. Alex, you have interacted with other devices that have pop-up selfie cameras, the Oppo Find X, the Vivo Nex, what was it called? The Nex something edition?
Nex. I forget. I think that was Andrew anyway. I mean, but I am familiar with it.
The Nex has a pop-up, yeah.
So this is going to be the first mainstream phone released in the West that has that feature. It's really interesting. I mean, I was prepared to hate it. I was like, this is absurd. It's a pop-up selfie camera with a motor. But I don't know. It's so far so not bad.
Yeah, I don't hate it. I was prepared to, you know, for it to be a dumb, annoying thing. But I think part of the fact is it's just so small. The module for, you know, where the camera lives is exactly as big as it needs to be, which means it's not very big. It's, you know, it pops up. It's like a mechanical twirl when it sort of raises up to that level. And you just use it the way you would use a normal selfie camera. You have a button in the camera app that opens up your little glow effect that appears at the top of the screen, and this thing just extends up, and you take your selfie and go on your merry way. And as far as other features like face unlock, also works fine. I have that set up as like a backup unlock method. You know, not that I really need it because the in-screen fingerprint's pretty good. I was prepared to hate it using face unlock, and I was talking to a OnePlus person earlier this week who had that set up on his own unit, and I was curious about how well that would work. Actually, it's not too bad because the sensor is pretty small, the unit is pretty small, and it takes a short amount of time to pop out of the top of the screen. And if you need to. Lift up, swipe, it extends, it stays there for a fraction of a second, then pops immediately back down, and it's, you know, imperceptibly, you know, pretty much the same speed compared to a 6T or something like that actually has a permanent, always open front-facing camera. In terms of quality, picture quality has been fine. It's just something else that you have to watch out for when you're actually extending it, because of course it is mechanical. There is potential for greater, you know, breakage and stuff like that. But more than any kind of mechanical problem, because obviously this has gyros in, it will collapse the camera back into the phone if it senses that it's falling, which is a pretty neat feature. Biggest issue for me is just the amount of lint that's been accumulating around that area. Because if it's in your pocket,
it's a bit of a dustbin.
It is, yeah. And how have you guys been finding that?
Yeah, every time it pops out, there's a considerable amount of little flecks of dust in there.
I mean, it is like, it does seem to have a physical cover, so I don't think dust is going to get inside the camera, but
no,
it is weird to have to.
I was told it's actually physically sealed inside, so that, you know, dust isn't going to get into the mechanism. There's no danger of that happening. But
that's,
yeah,
that's good.
There is the potential for dust maybe to get in the way of the shot you're taking, which perhaps is a bit more problematic.
But I mean, realistically, you're comparing it to every other selfie camera that just gets smudged to hell because you're swiping over it because it's in a notch. I mean, the Galaxy S10 front-facing camera is always smudged because that's where I reach up to pull down the notification shade. I'm always swiping over the camera. So, you know, a little bit of dust on the pop-up camera is not the end of the world.
I know this is also kind of a niche thing, but whenever I take a selfie with a phone that has a very small embedded selfie or front-facing camera, a lot of people don't know exactly where to look. And they'll say, like, am I looking at the top or the bottom? This, there is no ambiguity. You just know exactly where to stare. You're always going to look directly into the lens.
And it has
that little
animation to show you where to look as well. It has like the little sci-fi sort of laser thing that spreads out.
That's so very OnePlus. So, I think, I mean, of all things, like, that's not bad. And they've implemented it really well. They said that you can raise and lower the fingerprint, the selfie camera 300,000 times, which is a lot. But Samsung said that you can fold the Galaxy Fold 200,000 times. So those numbers are
rough.
Kind of meaningless.
So the number for raising and lowering, I think that's the maximum they tested to, and they found no issues with wear after that. So the 300,000 number that's the number of raises and lowers that you get. That's the amount they tested at and didn't find any defects after that. So I think the number was equivalent to something like 150 a day for 5 years, which is a lot of selfies.
That's a lot of selfies. Okay, so let's just talk about like overall size before we get into camera stuff, because this is a very big and very heavy phone. Andrew, this is 206 grams,
man,
which is a lot. It's considerably heavier than even the Galaxy Note 9. What's your take on this?
Heavier than the ceramic Galaxy S10 Plus.
That's true. It's because the S10 Plus is actually quite light.
Yeah, so this is about, 20 to 25 grams more than the standard S10 Plus, and you feel every bit of it. It really does feel heavy, and the people that I've handed this phone to immediately say it's heavy, even if they're already using something like an iPhone XS Max or a Galaxy S10 Plus or something like that. It has the upside of feeling solid and substantial. It feels like the weight is fully distributed across it. It doesn't feel, you know, really heavy on one side or the other, but I'm not sure if it's going to raise to the level of actually being an issue for anyone. And just like Alex was talking about with the display, it's something that people are really going to want to pick up in the store if they can, and at least like get a feel for this, because I think that the weight is a bigger hindrance to using it than anything necessarily about its size or shape. I mean, it's a standard big flagship. I mean, it's going to be really it's going to be really large and it's going to be kind of awkward to pick up and hold and stuff like that. And it is a little bit taller and a little bit wider, or roughly, I would say, the same width as the Galaxy S10 Plus. So, I mean, it is a big phone, but it just, you feel the weight more than anything.
I agree. And the fact that it's very slippery too, like we mentioned at the beginning, doesn't help you feel secure when you're holding it. But it does come with a case in the box. It's a clear TPU case, so cheap, and you may want to get your own. But there is that if you need it.
I think part of the issue with the slipperiness, though, is the color that we've been using, because there are, of course, multiple colors. The blue has a very matte texture to it, whereas the almond does not. I forget where the gray, which finish that has. But yeah, this is matte finished around the edges. The edges are very thin, so the main area that you're gripping is most of the time extremely slick, more so than something that has maybe a shiny glass back like a Galaxy S10.
Right.
And that's kind of cuts both ways. It doesn't, this is very much like the texture of the LG G8 and V40, mm-hmm. where it has, or at least those colors that have that kind of matte texture. It looks amazing. And it doesn't pick up smudges nearly as much. It doesn't get that gross, you know, kind of kind of watercolory look to it, like every single Samsung phone does.
Used a black Samsung phone for the past 2 years. You'll know exactly what Andrew's talking about.
Exactly. But what people, I guess, don't really realize is like those smudges, like they're helping you grip your phone. It's just not really appealing. So I can understand why they went with this. It looks really, really nice, especially in this dual, like kind of transitionary two-tone blue. But yeah, you're going to probably want to pick up that OnePlus Sandstone case, because that's all the grip you need.
It is. Yeah, it's what, like $30, $25, $30?
Something like that. And it's really thin, which is what I like.
Definitely. And OnePlus makes some of the best first-party cases you'll find, and I highly recommend spending. Like, if you're saving money on the phone over another flagship, just spend that extra money on a case. Let's talk a bit about the cameras, because this is, you know, we talked about the selfie camera. It's a 60-megapixel kind of standard, nothing special. But on the back, there's now a triple camera setup, and the main sensor is that Sony IMX586 that's shown up in basically every phone announced in the last 6 months that isn't like the Galaxy S10 or the P30 Pro. So, Alex, let's talk about it, because this is Sony's new... It forces you to do pixel binning.
All the megapixels.
So, yeah, it does a 4-in-1 pixel binning. Every single photo is 12 megapixels. And ostensibly, the pixel size becomes 1.6 microns when you combine the pixels together. How does that translate to real world photo quality?
Pretty well, as it turns out. So worth pointing out that as well as that Sony IMX 586 that's been in a lot of other phones, OnePlus, as far as I'm aware, they're the first to have that sensor, but also with OIS. So you have that sensor, which, you know, is pretty much proven at this point. You have optical stabilization, which we're missing, lets you hold the shutter open for longer, better low light performance, and you have an f1.6 lens, so plenty of light getting in there. So between just having decent quality optics and the decent ISP from the new Snapdragon processor, and all the goodness in the OnePlus photo app, including the nightscape mode, you're getting a substantial upgrade from any other OnePlus phone. You know, previous years, you know, the OnePlus phone would be a tier below a Samsung Galaxy or something like that. This is not quite up to the insane levels of night photography that you get with the Huawei P30 Pro, but it's getting there in a lot of other ways. It's and especially the main sensor is pretty versatile, and I've had a lot of fun shooting photos with this thing.
So there's also two other lenses or two other sensors. There's the telephoto lens. It's kind of a standard 8-megapixel. F2.4, I wouldn't be surprised if it's the same one that's found on the 6T. And
not great.
It's fine. It works. It does the trick.
The 6T.
Did 6T. I say that?
6T didn't have telephoto, did it?
You're right. It didn't. It was for depth. But they have the, was it the 6? Am I wrong about that?
You might be thinking of the Huawei P20 Pro last year that had the 3x telephoto at 8 megapixels. Anyway, there have been some phones that have had it before.
Also, yeah, I mean, the Galaxy S 9 and 10 have had the same F2.4 in front of a 16 megapixel 1 micron sensor.
No, so they're all trash.
you don't want to use any of them because, I mean, I like the fact that it's 3x rather than 2x. Mm-hmm. We've talked a lot about Samsung's telephoto kind of being useless because digital zoom is really good nowadays. And
especially if your main sensor is 48 megapixels.
Exactly. And so the 3x on here, like it's a cool story for OnePlus to be able to talk about having three cameras and doing things. But I took a lot of, I took a lot of comparison shots where I switched from, especially with like a big landscape where you have good variation of colors and things, and I switched between the wide normal telephoto. You notice a quality drop off from the normal to the wide, of course, but you know there's trade off there with the wide looking cool and all that. The telephoto looks considerably worse. It looks, it does not have the same amount of contrast or color depth or detail. And so it, you know, it's kind of like once you get to 3X and beyond, you're typically doing that because like there's just something over there that you need to take a photo of and you're willing to give it up, like give up some of the quality just to actually be able to see the thing. I would much rather, you know, be at 2X or so digitally zoomed on that main sensor than go to 3X and be on that little sensor with the tiny pixels.
It's funny, all the compromises you're describing there, I remember from my time with the P30 Pro and the experience with that 5x sensor as well, where you know, you'd have that sort of gap in quality between the main sensor in terms of color, in terms of contrast.
It's funny, I was thinking the 6T had telephoto, and then it occurred to me that they haven't had a telephoto since the OnePlus 5, but because they release phones so often, I can never tell which model was which.
Years ago in OnePlus time.
It was. It feels like a long time ago. But anyway, we're back to having a telephoto, and now we have that accompanying third sensor lens combo with the ultra wide. This is brand new to OnePlus. It was brand new to Samsung earlier this year. 16 megapixels, f/2.2. Andrew, we got confirmation that it does have autofocus, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, especially because I've been having issues with soft photos.
Yeah, I mean, but at the same time, just the field of view makes it very hard to focus on anything relatively close.
Right, which is why you typically don't do autofocus.
Yeah. Yeah, you just want everything. When in doubt, just put everything in focus.
Yeah, so what I've noticed is when you're taking one of these wide angle photos, you kind of have obviously a much wider field of view than you're used to, and it seems like it's maybe just not picking a good focal point, and so you're getting things that are really out of focus. So your typical wide angle camera, like on the Galaxy S10, it's just has a short minimum focal distance, but then focus is just set on infinity. Like it's just going to put everything in focus because you don't want to play around with that. And this case, if you're taking a photo of like, I don't know, I'm just looking at my Google Photos right now, a photo of a beach. So it's going to focus on, with like some rocks and stuff in the foreground. And then, the ocean just goes out. If it focuses kind of off in the distance, more on the water in the distance, everything in the foreground where there's, rocks or trees or bushes or whatever that's close to you is just going to be soft and out of focus. And that's kind of weird because we don't normally associate that with wide angle photos. We think wide angle, everything is kind of just right in front of you, and the change in perspective is kind of the whole point of using the wide angle. It's a little odd. I'm just not sure if it can be improved, or if you just kind of focus more on making sure you use tap to focus with the wide angle. I'm not really sure what the fix is there.
I think it's maybe just a software thing, and in terms of messing with the the minimal focal distance. Something that is interesting going from a Huawei phone is that you can't do the crazy like wide angle macro trick that you can with some of those devices. So Huawei has a super super close minimal focal distance, so you can actually get some really unique sort of up close pictures of you know, like animals or flowers or things like that. Not possible here. I think, you know, possibly just the computation behind doing autofocus with that kind of lens is maybe a little bit harder, and we just need to wait for some software trickery to fix that perhaps.
So camera quality, I think, has been something OnePlus has striven to improve every year. It's tried to do that with, you know, a number of ways, adding a secondary sensor to improve low light, to you know, help with depth, to basically just accompany that first sensor. I think this year we're seeing a drastic uptick in quality from the primary sensor, the actual processing. Andrew, you described it as sort of a in the middle between, say, a realistic pixel photo and more of an oversaturated Samsung mm-hmm. photo. You're kind of like hitting that happy medium. But in terms of, you know, photos that people are going to look at and go, wow, like that's among the best. You know, has OnePlus reached that yet?
I don't think that it's gotten up to that level. I think it's a very competent camera, especially when we were just talking about the main sensor. It's a very competent camera, and I haven't found situations where it just completely stumbles or has any problems. It's very much like Samsung's cameras in that way. The floor is really high, but I think the ceiling is just a bit lower. There were, you know, in that same way, when you compare it to something like the Pixel, I had far fewer instances where I took a photo that I was absolutely blown away by. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, the Pixel regularly delivers those where you're like, wow, I cannot believe that a smartphone took that photo. And especially when, you know, if I'm, you know, I'm spending time with people that have all kinds of different cameras, we're using shared Google Photos albums and things like that, especially this last weekend. And it's like, there's Pixel photos in there, there's Galaxy S10 photos, and there's OnePlus 7 photos. It's the perfect comparison. And I flip through them, and more often than not, the ones that I like and are saving to my library are the ones that I didn't take. That's because they're coming out of the Pixel and the Galaxy S10.
Right.
Interesting to compare, and I've had the Pixel 3a and 3a XL on my desk, as well as the OnePlus 7 Pro this week. And interesting to look at like nightscape on the OnePlus phone versus night sight on a Pixel. And considering the huge price difference now between the new mid-range Pixels and the new very high-end OnePlus phone, and there's really not an awful lot in it. And a lot of the time, especially in very dark conditions, despite having, you know, a huge computational power disadvantage, Google will still give you a better looking night shot with more detail and like just a crisper looking, less sort of blurry, weird looking shot. It's still really hard to beat in that area.
Well, I mean, if you can do that on the 3A, you know, it doesn't have a lot to do with hardware, or at least not nearly as much to do with hardware as people thought.
Sure.
But I mean, this is still, I think, a really impressive camera, and at least an impressive camera setup. It allows you to be way more versatile, allows you to pick your shots better. It's just more fun to use. And, you know, we have to mention the OnePlus software, the camera apps, really good, reliable, and just
very
Oxygen
fast.
OS is great. It's still, you know, aside from the Pixel, it's probably my favorite version of what Android is and can be, with a few nice tweaks this year.
Yeah, I absolutely love the software. It's just, you know, it's like riding a bike. You get right back on it, and it's everything works exactly what you how you want, and you can customize a good amount of things. But I think the biggest way for anybody that hasn't used one for whatever reason, the biggest way to describe it is that nothing gets in the way of what you want to do. And then beyond that, if you do want to tweak and mess with things, go ahead, and it'll give you lots of different options, and they have, you know, some extra enhancements and special modes and stuff like that. But really, just out of the box, toss the stuff on it that you want, it's super clean and fast and consistent. And again, especially with the 90 hertz screen, everything just feels like it's just happening before you even finish that swipe or that tap. It's just right there. Mm-hmm. And I just, it's one of OnePlus's biggest selling points. It's just really hard to get across to people until they've used it and just don't have to think about it. That's the craziest thing. You don't have to think about the quality of the software because it just kind of fades away. It's the kind of the old school Android style where it's just so bare bones in many respects that you don't think about it.
At the same time, you have that sort of shop floor sort of argument that you have someone going in there maybe with a 3-year-old Samsung phone with all kinds of bloat on it that's slowed down over the years, and then you hand them this thing, you know, the combination of the super fast storage with the 90 hertz screen and just the fact that OxygenOS in general is pretty damn fast, that the difference in performance that you're going to see immediately going from any kind of old Android phone is going to be pretty spectacular. Also got to give a shout out to OnePlus's gesture setup, which I think is the only full screen gesture setup on Android that makes me not want to shoot myself.
It's funny though, this week we learned that Google will force manufacturers to include its gestures that are coming to Android Q along with its 3-button nav, and will also allow manufacturers to include their own custom gestures. So we may have a situation where we have two different types of gesture navigation systems on a OnePlus phone and others, but
yeah, that's
I don't
fine
think that's going to happen.
Yeah,
I think OnePlus maybe is just going to relent and give in to Google.
I don't know. I think OnePlus has been very receptive to their audience. I think if you have a lot of people that really appreciate this gesture setup that is really fast and really convenient to use and works with hamburger menus unlike Google's, I could see them just adding Google's to the list and having, you know, okay, you have your old school one, your Pixel swipey pill thing, and your OnePlus setup, and your new terrible iPhone copy setup in the next version of Android.
And that's just how that's just kind of how they roll in many respects. Yeah, out of the box, like, let it just be 3 buttons, but ever other people, you know, want to do something different, they're like, yeah, sure.
They've never been afraid to add another setting to the list.
I mean, what's really interesting is just how divisive Google's new gesture system is, or is proving to be. Because I like it, and I think once developers fix the, you know, hamburger menu problem,
Which will be improved.
I think you're identifying the wrong thing as the problem there, Daniel.
what's the problem?
The problem is the gesture setup that they're gonna force on the next generation of their phones that is inevitably gonna make a vast quantity of apps really, really horrible to use, including their own apps.
This is one case where you're happy that Q is going to take a long time to arrive.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going off the rails a little bit with this, but yeah, I think it's, unless there are some drastic changes in the next few versions, it's going to be there are going to be some interesting experiences waiting for people trying to use apps and trying to swipe in, and just total confusion around that. I think
call it back a gate.
Mm.
What I find interesting though is I agree with you. I like OnePlus's gestures, but I end up turning them off and putting the pill gestures back, not because I like the pill gestures better, but because I can't type using Gboard when it's so low. And there's no floating Gboard yet. There's floating Swift key, but I prefer Gboard. I know this is so inside baseball, but it just goes to show, like, there's always something. You'll always find one thing about Android that frustrates you, and another way to fix it that breaks something else. So
the interesting thing about keyboards is I've actually noticed this, and I'm not sure whether this is a new OxygenOS thing or a 7 Pro thing specifically, but it does now render a little bit of white space below Gboard, and I assume other keyboards as well, which I really appreciate when I'm using the gestures. The only annoying thing I've found is it also renders that when you're using buttons.
It does.
So you kind of unless you want to be reaching way, way up, there's no way to control the amount of white space that you get, or, you know, the condition on which you get it. So it's kind of like, well, it's tough typing whatever you do.
tough cookies.
Mm.
But yeah, I think, you know, OnePlus has done a great job overall with this. What else do you want to talk about?
Zen mode.
Right.
Yeah, how Alex, do we not?
Walk us through this. I don't even want to call it innovative. It's just bizarre.
It's just a thing.
It's a thing, yeah.
This new feature.
There's this great new feature that lives in the quick settings area that when you press it and after you confirm that you really, really want to, will break your phone. It will not totally break it, but it will mean you basically can't use your phone for 20 minutes. It's designed to help you disconnect from distractions and just, you know, put your phone down for a little while. So the way it works is it'll walk you through what will happen. It will suggest some reasons why you might want to do this, like, I don't know, if it's date night, if you want to just spend some time with your cats, if you're at a dinner party. It gives you some examples of good times to...
If you're at a dinner party with your cats, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Any of the combination reasons. Of the above. So, yeah, you press the button, you get a 20-minute timer, and you can make emergency calls, you can receive calls, and you can use the camera, but you can do nothing else for 20 minutes. And there is no way out of this. There's no escape hatch. There's no, you can't even reboot. If you reboot, the timer will just still be there. So yeah, it's an enforced 20 minutes that you can't use your phone. And, you know, so if you're lost somewhere, then, you know, you're just screwed, I guess. You can't look at Google Maps. You can't receive messages through any other app. Notifications will still arrive at your phone, but you won't be able to see them or act on them until that 20 minutes is up. So it's an interesting part of the whole digital balance, you know, digital well-being trend that we've seen over the past year. Digital well-being, by the way, is now in this phone officially. I think you could sideload it on OnePlus phones before, but now Google's digital well-being is just a part of OxygenOS, which is nice to see. I think just among us, we've had our own sort of mixed reactions to it. I'm kind of okay with it. Daniel, I think you have maybe some opinions to the contrary.
No, I just find it interesting that, you know, we were talking to OnePlus's representatives about this, and, you know, their whole thing is it's just 20 minutes, right? Like you got to be smart enough to enable this in a situation where you're probably not going to be in an emergency, you know, if you're lost. Like if you're enabling Zen mode in the middle of a forest when you don't know where you're going, that's on you. So
maybe you want to enable Zen mode. Maybe you want to be disconnected in the middle of your forest.
Then turn your phone off. But this is, I think, I keep trying to wrap my head around this idea of like forced entrapment, that you're putting yourself in a situation where the only thing you can do with your phone is to receive calls, and that's it. And there's no other way. You physically cannot. You can't. There's no compatibility mode. There's no emergency escape. There's nothing.
I mean, there is the ability to make a 911 call. You can make an emergency call if you really, really need to. So there is that escape hatch if something goes horribly, horribly wrong. But with the nature of this feature, if there is an escape hatch, it almost defeats the point of it. Like, why is it there if you can just click a prompt, you know, okay, and get around it? It's the same argument with limits on app timers in digital well-being. At least digital well-being, you know, you have to go through a bunch of extra steps and, you know, navigate through menus to re-enable an app once it's once your timer's up. But yeah, if you if you're going to do this kind of feature, this is the way it has to work.
And OnePlus says that the reason they added it was at the behest of its community, that their community asked for this during a bunch of sessions the company held throughout 2018. They asked for the features that only OnePlus could add, or features that its community wanted. And this was something that came up again and again. We want help figuring out how to force ourselves to use our phones less. And when you put it, you know, in that perspective, I mean, OnePlus has always attracted a very dedicated core group of very loyal group of users. But at the same time, many of those users, like us, are probably quite addicted to their phones. I'll be honest, the idea of using this causes me a bit of anxiety. Even though I have a million other phones, it's not the problem. It's just the notion of like you cannot pick up and use your phone, period. It's interesting. I find it to be an interesting experiment. I don't think it's going to get a lot of use.
it's going to be a very personal decision, much like, you know, whether you choose to put the self-restrictions on yourself with digital well-being. You know, I don't necessarily have this problem, so I don't even have an opinion on it. Like, if I don't want to use the phone, I just flip that very nice alert slider on the right side to the very top where it's silent, and you just set the phone down. But some people do want that forced mode. And like Alex was saying, if you have the escape hatch, it defeats the purpose of this feature, and you don't have to use the feature. So I'm, you know, it's completely separate from all the other do not disturb and alert slider and things like that. Mm-hmm. I wish that they had something more akin to Google's flip to shush, which I really, really like, is one of my favorite features of the Pixels, where you put your phone face down and it enables do not disturb for the duration that it's face down. That's kind of a nice little middle ground and kind of physical, a physical choice with the phone, you know, maps to the software choice, which is really nice. But I mean, I give them kudos for coming up with something new. I don't think that many people are going
to
use it.
My bigger main concern is, you know, not any, you know, anything to do with real safety or anything, although perhaps it could be the potential for abuse there, in that it is just there in the quick settings menu. You know, someone could grab your phone if it's already unlocked, yank, you know, pull a notification down, press the button, tap through the prompts, and your phone is pretty much a brick for the next 20 minutes. Because there's no fingerprint prompt, there's no security pattern prompt to enable it once your phone is already unlocked, which seems like maybe a bit of an oversight.
Yeah, fingerprint to enable would be nice.
And it's also interesting, Google announced its own, you know, mode,
focus
or
mode,
upgrade,
yeah,
to digital well-being,
which will be coming to the 7 Pro as well, since it's coming to all devices with Pi.
Right. I mean, and that's not as severe, but it'll allow you to stop apps from being used. They get grayed out, similar to app timers, but it won't let you open the app at all. You'll have to override it. I was listening to a podcast with, you know, a former Googler. It was a podcast hosted by Kara Swisher, Recode Decode. It was all about the way that the industry should feel obligated, or at least that we should be holding big tech companies like Google and Facebook and Apple to account for making their software as addictive as they can, as they have, and making the phones as addictive as they have. And we haven't really talked about phone addiction on this podcast that much, and this is certainly not the topic that we want to, you know, digress to today. But I do find it interesting that more companies are taking this problem seriously, and the ways that they're addressing it are increasingly unique and sometimes increasingly severe, like we have with Zen Mode. So I guess we'll come back in 6 months and say, hey, have you tried Zen Mode? Oh, wait, there's a Zen Mode. So, well, that remains to be seen. All right, what else should we talk about with this phone?
The battery life, because...
Right,
the
4,000 milliamp hour battery that Alex thinks is actually smaller than the number suggests.
Well, not in the sense that you go to certain markets in China and it's like a 50,000 milliamp hour battery that's the size of a, I don't know, a postage stamp. But no, this is it does have a real, honest to God, 4,000 milliamp hour battery. It does have a warp charge, like the Warp Charge 30, which I believe is the same spec that was in the what was the special version of the 60 last year?
Oh, the McLaren.
Oh, the McLaren.
Yeah. So that's back. So it's faster than the old Dash Charge. You know, nice fast refills, which you will probably need because the battery life on this is not so good. It's not terrible, but I think I would certainly say that this is the weakest battery life I've seen from a phone with this battery capacity. And there are a few reasons that perhaps we could get into that might be the case.
And the weakest of any OnePlus phone, which means that it's just kind of which means it's just kind of average, which, so like a step down from what we expect from OnePlus phones means that it's just about average, which is disappointing, of course, for a OnePlus phone, where the 6 and 6T were just absolute, you know, you could do anything and they would not die. That's, I think, part of that trade-off has to be pointed at the display, which is bigger and brighter and has this great refresh rate and is quad HD. That definitely has to go into it. And it's just, it is a little disappointing just from the fact that we talked about how big and heavy this phone is. And the battery life just is not as good as the Galaxy S10 Plus for me.
Yeah, and even worse for me, I'd be coming from the Huawei P30 Pro, which is, I think, probably has the best battery life of any phone I've ever used. And so the contrast on that is really, really stark. And yeah, in terms of my usage, yeah, I mean, a screen on time is never 100% reliable indicator, but I'm approaching maybe like 4 hours. I can definitely chew through half of this battery very, very quickly, doing things like, you know, watching any kind of video content, anything involving a lot of screen usage, and a lot of screen usage at 90 Hertz, will very quickly get through the capacity of that battery.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I'm not having the same issues. It's 2:30 Eastern as we're recording this, and I'm at 76%. But the one thing that you've raised, Alex, which I guess is a possible cause for the difference that we're experiencing, is I've been on Wi-Fi quite a lot on my phone, and you said that you've been traveling and you've been on cellular.
I was also shooting video this morning, and while I was on Wi-Fi, and I noticed a similar battery drain, so not sure.
And there must be ways to alleviate it, right? You can permanently change it back to 60 Hertz. You can manually change the screen resolution down to full HD again, which should probably save a little bit.
Like Samsung does by default.
Yeah. And this is dynamic by default too. So
I've been chopping and changing between 90 Hertz and 60 Hertz, and I'm not noticing a huge difference between the two. 90 definitely will, like I said, chew through that battery so quickly. 60, I've still found to be less than great in terms of battery life.
OnePlus does say, though, that it's dynamic, so that when the screen is not moving, it changes back to 60 Hertz. Mm-hmm. And only once you tap on the screen does it increase to 90 Hertz.
Yeah. But there's no reason to expect that it wasn't doing, it doesn't do that with lower refresh rates when it's at 60 anyway. I had this whole conversation with Razer when they released the Razer phone with 120 Hertz screen, and they, you know, they showed how they were doing that. And that's just something that you can do with any refresh rate, I think, and to preserve battery power. So I will perhaps need to dig into this in a little bit more detail, but it certainly does seem like the trade-off there is to do with the screen. And, you know, there's one big new feature in the screen to point to that might be, it might make it so that you only get, you know, average or slightly above average battery life with what used to be considered quite a large battery capacity.
Yeah, the phone has never left me stranded. I've just, even on, you know, I've taken 3 flights in the last week and spent a lot of time doing a lot of heavy work around the first day of I/O especially. And the phone hasn't left me like scrambling for a charger. It just hit battery saver at 15% more often than I've experienced on any other OnePlus phone. It just felt, you know, it didn't feel superhuman anymore. It just felt, you know, regular human.
It's also the first Snapdragon 855 phone that I've heard people complain about the battery. You know, the LG G8 has a, I think, 3,500 milliamp hour battery. Nobody was like, oh, this is terrible. They weren't like, this is amazing. But it met expectations for the size of the phone. This is the first one I've heard, not just from you, Alex, that people are complaining that the 4,000 milliamp hour battery should not have uptime this low.
And Alex and I talked about the 7 Pro still has great standby battery life, mm-hmm. Which again kind of points to the display component, or, you know, whatever is happening when you're actively using the phone. It still will just idle all day. You can set it on the table and it's not doing anything. It's going to be totally fine. Or if, you know, for whatever reason you can't charge overnight and it needs to just sit there, you'll be completely fine. It just seems to drain more when you're actively in use, which is still a good, I mean, it's still a good characteristic to have. You want it to drain battery when you're actually using it, not the other way around. Whereas, you know, Samsung phones kind of typically just have that, you know, 45 degree angle. It just kind of drains no matter what. But still, you know, if the end result is, you know, I'm ending days like kind of in the low 20% range, maybe I make it to battery saver mode if I have a late evening. That just doesn't fill me with as much confidence as before, where I knew that a casual day I would end at 40-something percent, and a heavy day I never reached battery saver.
It's perhaps less predictable as a result. I think the the standby battery drain that we expect maybe a little bit more from a phone like a Samsung phone, you know, there are ways to mitigate that. And, the, you know, in terms of like fixing bugs in firmware, there are a lot of things that can be done there. I'm not sure there's much that can really be done in firmware to get dramatically better battery life from a 7 Pro if it is just the screen.
And still, I don't think that this is going to be a big negative for this phone. It's just no longer a massive positive for me. And if the trade-off is to get this great of a display, I mean, shoot, the display is really, really good. So I'm not, you know, too upset about it, even if you do draw a one-to-one correlation there. It's just unfortunate that it's not killing the Galaxy S10 Plus.
Mm. And for my money, I think this probably, I mean, you're right, it's not a huge negative mark, but I think the other side of that is, it for me, it's probably the only negative mark, which maybe makes it stand out. Or it's all more frustrating that this one thing is slightly less good than we would hope.
Sure, and warp charge is really great. But the problem is I don't have warp chargers all over the place. I have USB-C power delivery plugs.
Well,
and
well,
I
whose,
have
whose problem is that?
and another one that, you know, we've mentioned before is I have USB PD batteries too, and I have quick charge batteries. There is no way to get dash charge, warp charge, whatever in a battery from OnePlus right now. And so in those, like, those are the situations in which, like, if you're carrying around a battery and a cable, like, that is the time where you're like, okay, battery life really matters, and like having my phone be alive really matters. And OnePlus doesn't offer that battery option for its fastest charging standard.
So I apologize if anyone just heard a click on my line. That was me unplugging my MacBook and plugging in my OnePlus 7 Pro to try and see if this phone has USB power delivery, which OnePlus phones traditionally haven't. And it doesn't look like it does, given the speeds I'm getting. So yeah, that's the other side of it. You know, increasingly now you can plug in pretty much any modern Android phone into a USB PD plug, like a MacBook charger or whatever else, and you'll get pretty fast charging speeds. Not so much with this phone.
And that's the thing, is that the delta between regular USB-C charging and warp charging is going to be massive if this doesn't support PD.
Yeah, like switching to 5-volt, 2.4-amp, like just USB charging is brutal on a 4,000 milliamp hour battery.
I was, so I got this phone down to maybe 30% yesterday, fired at ampere, which lets you measure the charge rate of phones, on the warp charge, and it was pulling down something like 5.8 amps, I think. So pretty decent amount of juice.
That's a lot.
Absolutely is.
But no wireless charging, which sucks.
Which, I've put this thing on a wireless charger many times. my brain does not accept that it doesn't have wireless charging. Part of that is maybe because it just feels kind of like a Galaxy S10, mm-hmm. which I was using before I switched to this. And so, like, bedside table, I reach over there and put it on there. I'm like, oh, yeah, it really should have wireless charging.
And I think the reason that it doesn't isn't so much that they couldn't put the coil in there. Rather, I think it's the same reason it doesn't have USB PD. It's the same reason it doesn't have an IP rating. It's that they just wouldn't want to license the tech to do what they would need to do with that coil to wirelessly charge it. So they could probably put the hardware in there, but they wouldn't want to pay the per unit cost to get it to perform.
Yeah, so you let us know, like, is that a fair trade-off to save money? I mean, you have licensing that's saved from, as Alex said, wireless charging, from IP rating. You know, USB PD, these are all fees that OnePlus would have had to pay to the man and then pass it along to you. That's a lot of why phones are more expensive these days. So let us know, podcast at Android Central, what you think. Let's end by sort of touching on the strategy here of releasing a cheaper OnePlus 7 in some parts of the world, releasing a more expensive 7 Plus in other parts of the world, or 7 Pro, and then selling the OnePlus 6T in those markets where the 7 Pro will be available. What do you think the reason is, Alex? And is that necessarily a good one, a good thing or a bad thing for consumers?
So to start with, I think the 6T is going to be a bit of a weird outlier. I think we were talking about this a little bit before the podcast, and the conclusion we came to is that probably they're just going to keep the 6T around until they just deplete the stock, and that's going to be the end of it. I think the sort of relationship between the 7 and the 7 Pro, like I touched on at the start of the podcast, it's to give that expectation of, okay, the 7 is what you would expect OnePlus to normally have, and the Pro is like this new, is the new hotness. I think it's you know, for them, obviously, it's been a per market decision on what, which phone they release in which territory. With the US, they obviously see that as a premium market where, you know, they want to push the flagship phone in T-Mobile on as many stores as they, in as many stores as they want to. I think maybe they might have thought that selling the 7 might eat into sales there and might potentially, you know, especially with an important partner like T-Mobile, they might cannibalize their own sales. Whereas if you just have one high-priced option, maybe that's more suitable for the US. Other markets, you have like, you know, Europe and Asia and India, you have people who maybe are older OnePlus fans who expect a cheaper phone. Maybe the market is more sort of geared towards that kind of device. So maybe it makes sense to release the phone that you would perhaps expect from OnePlus, the cheaper one, that has the same core specs, but only two cameras, and has the same screen and the same battery and the same charging speed as the 6T. And of course, the interesting thing about the 7 is, if you look at it, it basically just looks like a OnePlus 6T. It's a 6T with slightly upgraded internals and a better camera. And a lot of people, that'll be a perfectly decent upgrade. Anyone coming from maybe a OnePlus 5, that's a decent upgrade that you're getting there.
And do we know pricing yet? I don't think we do.
We don't. I don't think we have any official pricing. I think the only pricing we might have is leaked, but no, nothing
around the
official
same
to
as the OnePlus 6T.
You would expect so, yeah. It would be around the price that you would more commonly associate with a OnePlus phone.
We're also going to learn a bit more about the 5G version of the 7 Pro at the event. Obviously, we're recording this before the event itself, so just want to, you know, full disclosure there. But
we do know a little bit, at least I was told a little bit. So it's basically just the exact same phone with 5G. So no different battery, no different internals, no different dimensions. It is literally just your OnePlus 7 Pro with different antennas and probably with a bit of a battery hit from those 5G speeds.
Battery hit. So it's kind of a grimace emoji.
Yeah.
Right there. Well, I mean, it'll be a first-gen product, just like most 5G products in 2019. But if you want it, you can buy it.
It's significant that there's not any sort of extra thing like you get with a Galaxy S10 5G, like a bigger screen or an extra camera. It is literally just the same phone. So,
yeah,
pretty much no reason to buy it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Final thoughts. Should people buy the 7 Pro when it goes on sale on the 17th?
It is. I think it's a pretty easy recommendation. If you're someone that is willing to pay for more, you know, they're not you tied to something like the Pixel 3a XL at 480. You know, if you're above that point, that means you're kind of going all the way at that point, and you're not going to be upset by this thing being 669. Or what I would recommend is just like chip in the extra $30 and get the higher end model to get 8 gigs of RAM and 256 storage. Like, it is just a great, great deal at $700 when everything else that compares well to it is 150 to 250 more. It's just like, if you're at all price conscious, but you're willing to, you know, pay for quality, this thing is like there's just not a lot of reservations mm-hmm. there. If you can handle the size, which you're basically getting no matter what when you talk about high-end phones.
As much as this is a very different OnePlus phone, the reason to buy it is the same as pretty much any other flagship OnePlus phone. It's that you have to spend so much more to get more if you're stepping up to anything else beyond this.
Yeah, it's a considerable price jump for a small difference.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. Yeah, I think that's a great way to end the show. Alex, Andrew, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun. And I'm really excited to hear what you have to say in your full reviews, because you are, Andrew, you're writing the written review. Alex, you're doing
the
video. Those will be available when this is published. So please read those. Go to androidcentral.com to find all of that and all of our OnePlus 7 coverage. And thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Bye.